but it was too late. I'd certainly been judicious with the toilet paper, but my shit was so large, so audacious, that I knew it would clog up that toilet and flood the bathroom. Nobody wants to be the guy who clogs the toilet, let alone the commode only two rooms removed from his mother's coffin. I realized that I needed to break my own shit into pieces in order to make it easier to flush. But I also knew that the toilet would still clog if I tried to flush all of the pieces at once. So I wrapped my right hand in paper, reached into the toilet, and chopped my shit into four manageable fragments. Then, using my paper-wrapped right hand as a dam, I held three pieces out of the water as I flushed the toilet with my left hand. And then I waited a few minutes for the old toilet to refill so I could flush that second piece of shit. And then I waited for even more minutes so I could flush the third piece of shit. And then finally, after maybe 5 minutes, I was finally able to flush the last piece of shit. And then I washed my hands with all the liquid soap in the world. I walked out of the bathroom to see the Undertaker waiting for me. "Are you okay?" he asked. I was embarrassed. "Yes," I said. "I just wanted to make sure you were okay," he said. "You were in there a long time." He was genuinely concerned. I knew his empathy was real. I knew I could be honest with him. I said, "I just took a grief poop like you wouldn't believe. You ever seen a grief poop? Thing was as big as a walrus." The Undertaker touched my shoulder. "Happens all the time," he said. He wished me well and said he would see me at the tribal longhouse the next day for my mother's wake and funeral. He walked me to the door. He said another goodbye. He wished me well again. He patted me on the shoulder, but he didn't shake my hand. Chapter 19, The Procession. The Undertaker drove my mother's body to the reservation, but he didn't use a hearse. No, he drove a black minivan converted into a more contemporary and fuel-efficient funeral carriage. I guess death now has a smaller carbon footprint. Behind the Undertaker was the procession of 17 cars filled with family and friends. It took less than an hour to deliver my mother's body back to our reservation. I thought it would feel more epic, but it only felt like a sad and brief commute. Chapter 20, Nonfiction. We buried Lily and Alexei on July 6, 2015. We'd thought about burying her on the 4th of July, but the funeral expenses would have doubled and tripled because of the holiday. Yes, saying goodbye to a Native American woman would have cost us more on Independence Day. Chapter 21, Blood. At my mother's wake, a mosquito alights on my knuckle and sucks and fattens on my blood. I ponder smashing the damn thing so I could pretend to read my fortune in the broken insect pieces. But instead, I allow that mosquito to fly away, fat and drunk. I don't know if I loved my mother. I don't know if she loved me. At my mother's wake, another mosquito alights on another knuckle and sucks and fattens on my blood. When it reaches maximum density, I smash the damn thing and read my fortune in the broken insect pieces. One wing says, "Yes, you did love your mother." And another wing says, And yes, yes, of course, your mother loved you. But the dismembered proboscis shouts, you don't have to forgive her sins or your sins, but it's probably best if you give it a try, you blood bag of a son. At my mother's wake, a third mosquito buzzes my ear, and a fourth, and a fifth, and a dozen more. They're singing for my mother. It is only the female mosquitoes who know how to speak, who know how to sing, who know how to grieve. So I stand at 3 in the morning in the tribal longhouse, and I hum and hum and hum along, because I'm only a man who doesn't know any of the words or music to this death song. Chapter 22, Needle and Thread. My brother wanted to bury my mother with the necklace gifted to her by her late husband, our late father. But my sister says, you want us to bury her with all of her jewelry like she's Cleopatra? We gave away that necklace to a granddaughter instead. We gave away other necklaces and rings and beaded medallions to cousins and friends. We gave it away because an Indian's wealth is determined by what they lose and not by what they save. We gave away her clothes to secondhand stores, and we gave her deathbed back to the hospice. But we kept her TV because that thing is HD and epic and awesome. But we don't know what to do with the mounds of loose fabric that my mother kept for quilting. There must be 500 pounds of blue jeans, says my sister. She says, the only people who need that much denim are Mr. Levi and Mr. Wrangler themselves. I tell my sister we should stitch random pieces together and make 500 scarecrows. Then we'll round up wild bison and tie those scarecrows onto the bison's backs, like angry denim and calico warriors. And then we'll herd those scarecrowed bison into big trucks, drive them into Spokane or even into Washington, D.C., and release them into the streets and turn it all into a huge political installation art thing that we'll call Honor Our Treaty Rights, You Criminal White Motherfuckers from Hell. My sister laughs and ponders that for a bit. Then she says, you've got a lot of crafty ambition for an Indian boy who can't sew for shit. Chapter 23, How to Be an Atheist at a Spokane Indian Christian Funeral. We stay awake for 29 hours. We sisters and brothers, to guide our dead mother as she transitions into something else. If we are not here near her coffin, she might rise and wander from sweat lodge to trading post to post office to church in search of us, and maybe miss the last bus to whatever happens next. I don't believe in the afterlife, but I stay awake to honor my siblings' grief and our mother's theology. I don't believe in God, but I pray anyway. And when it is time to throw dirt onto my mother's coffin, I say goodbye only in my head. I don't believe I will see her again, but I know I will see my siblings because we are still alive. So I try to remain respectfully silent, even when the evangelical Indian preacher delivers a graveside tangent about the rapture and how true believers will be lifted into heaven at 186,000 miles per minute, at 186,000 miles per minute, at 186,000 miles per minute. Oh, You dumb ass fundamentalist, I think. The speed of light is 186,000 miles per second. And then I laugh and laugh because I imagine my mother in charge of her own damn story as she slowly, slowly ascends into her personal glory. Dear God, she texts. I'll get there when I get there. I know the path. Just leave a key under the welcome mat. Chapter 24, Brother Man. I have seen my big brother cry only twice in my life. The first in 1977 when our mother gathered us in my brother's basement bedroom to tell us that Arthur Tooley, my brother's best friend who'd the previous year moved from our reservation to another, had drowned in the Yakima River. Upon hearing the news, my brother fell to the floor like a skinny stick and wept so hard that I feared he would aspirate his pain and dry drown. The second time I saw my brother cry was at our mother's funeral. As we adult siblings stood together at my mother's open coffin with our arms wrapped around one another in a grief scrum, collectively we five siblings must weigh 1,600 pounds. Shit, we're a defensive line of hunger and insatiable sorrow. At our mother's coffin, my brother shook so violently that I thought he might fall again, a much more dangerous thing now that he was over 50 years old with gout, arthritis, and fragile hips. But he leaned against the coffin, supported by our mother one last time, and kept his balance. But oh, he cried into his fists, and I cried too, but more for my brother's loss than for the loss of our mother. Truth be told, I had only seen her three or four times a year over the last decade of her life and talked to her on the phone maybe twice a month. I had become the farthest planet orbiting her, but my brother had lived his entire life never more than 10 minutes away from our mother's star. He loved her far more than I did, so I knew his grief was larger and more pure than mine. I grieved that I hadn't been loved enough by our cold mother, while my brother mourned her. I am the brother with money and fame, but he is the brother who possesses the most kindness and pain. I wonder if I will ever see him weep again. I wonder if I want to see my brother weep again. I have never known how to comfort him. I don't even know how to take his joy, as when, moments after we'd learned about Arthur Tooley's death, we got a phone call from Arthur's mother to tell us that it was a different Arthur Tooley who had drowned. My brother's best friend was alive. Oh, my brother rose to his feet and slammed himself against his bedroom door. Laughing, he shadowboxed the air. Laughing, he punched as if he wanted to push the house from its foundation. Laughing, he thanked God, and he thanked our mother, and then he stopped laughing. Threw one last punch against the air, wiped the tears from his face, and went searching and searching and searching for lunch. Chapter 25, Silence. From winter 1987 until summer 1990, my mother and I didn't say a word to each other. Not through letters, not on the phone, not through intermediaries, and not in person. She and I didn't speak to each other when we were in the same house, not when we were in the same room, not when we were in the same car. I tried to break the silence in 1989 when my parents drove to Pullman, Washington to give me cash to pay the rent for my college apartment. My father chatted in the living room with Carrie, my white girlfriend, while I walked outside to make peace with my mother, sitting in the car. You have to talk to her. Carrie had said a few moments before my parents arrived. She's your mother. That particular argument didn't quite convince me. After all, Gertrude was Hamlet's mother, and look how that ended up. My mother is crazy, I said. She reminds me of Zsa Zsa Gabor, Carrie said. I remember that Zsa Zsa was a Hungarian-born actress and socialite. I'd never seen any of her movies or TV shows, and I'd certainly never attended any of her society parties. But I still knew so many details about her life. As they say, she was famous for being famous. Zsa Zsa was charismatic in the banal and voracious way that reality stars like Kim Kardashian are charismatic now. Why does my mom remind you of Zsa Zsa? I asked Carrie. Because your mom gets all the attention, like a beautiful actress, she said. And she has a fancy accent. My mom is from the Rez, I said and laughed. Rez accents are the opposite of fancy. You just say that because you don't like the sound of your voice, Carrie said. But Rez accents make everything sound like music. I waved away the compliment. Should I marry a man who doesn't talk to his mother? Carrie asked. You think I want a mother-in-law who treats her son this way, too? Maybe you two should marry each other, or marry yourselves. You're like the same person anyway. Carrie often said insightful and funny shit like that. She was an eccentric small-town empath. So, because I respected Carrie and her opinions, and because I missed talking to my mother, I tried to end the silence. To make amends. To restart our relationship. To do something. I was desperate. As I walked toward my mother, sitting alone in the car, I knew she was aware of me. She knew I was walking toward her. She knew I was going to use my words. It was a strangely religious experience. Like I was a pilgrim searching for wisdom from a monk who had not spoken in 100 years. Hey, Mom, I said. She didn't respond. She was making a scarf or baby blanket or some rectangular object of beauty. All I could hear was the click, click of her knitting needles. Mom, I said, talk to me. Knitting needles. Mom, please. Click, click. Furious, I spun and rushed back to my apartment. I passed my father along the way. Bye, Dad, I said. We were poor Indians. It was always a struggle to find enough money to enjoy a decent life, let alone pay for college. I was grateful to him for paying that month's rent, but I was too mad to properly show my appreciation. I was an asshole. Back in the apartment, I yelled at Carrie. You told me to talk to her. You made me do it, and she just ignored me. It was embarrassing. Like I said, I was an asshole. I screamed, ran at the living room wall, and slammed into it like I was trying to tackle the apartment building. Then I punched the wall once, twice, three times. I left a shoulder-shaped dent in the cheap plasterboard and three fish-shaped holes. I was lucky I only punched through the hollow plasterboard and didn't break my hand on a wooden or metal wall stud. Now, after years of good mental health care, I can look back and see my rage. My assholery was mostly the product of undiagnosed and untreated post-traumatic stress disorder and bipolar emotional swings. But in my youth, I only knew that I needed to physically, if irrationally, express my rage. I didn't want to hit my mother or my father or Carrie or anybody else, so I punched objects. I punched metaphors. So, at that moment, I would have certainly kicked our metaphorical God in his even more metaphorical nuts if I'd been given the chance. Carrie, bored and scared by my self-righteous and self-pitying temper, gathered up her things and walked back to her apartment. We'd flirted in high school and had kissed a few times. And then we dated in college until a year after she graduated. She didn't want to marry a writer, she said. Especially one who's probably going to be famous. Yes, she believed in my artistry, if not my marriageability. I used her manual typewriter to write my first 200 or 300 poems and stories. You want to know the identity of my first muse and benefactor? She was a math and science-minded white woman with an auto mechanic father. Carrie fed me when I had no money. I loved her. She loved me. But I don't know how much joy she experienced while loving me. I don't know how much joy I was capable of feeling or providing. So, after my mother ignored me again, and after I made holes in the walls, and after Carrie walked home, I rounded up some poet friends, none of whom write anymore, and we pulled our meager resources and got drunk in the cocktail bar of a Chinese restaurant. We drunkenly vowed to start our own literary magazine, like all drunken student poets do, but we'd publish only the good shit, which meant that we'd print only our poems and any poems that sounded exactly like ours. Then we argued about naming the magazine. "Let's call it The Silent Mother," I said. I remember that one of my friends, it was probably Old John, said The Silent Mother sounded more like a Betty Davis movie than a poetry magazine. Zsa Zsa Gabor. Betty Davis. Lillian Alexi. It might sound ludicrous to think of my mother as being a part of that grandiose trinity, but she really did loom that large for me. And she loomed that large in our tribe. She was wildly intelligent, arrogant, opinionated, intimidating, and generous with her time and spirit. She was a contradictory person. She was all by herself an entire tribe of contradictions. What do you call a gathering of women like Lillian? A contradiction of mothers. At her funeral, half of the mourners talked about being kindly rescued by my mother. For many years, she was the drug and addiction treatment counselor for our tribe. She helped at least a dozen addicts get clean and stay clean. She helped many other addicts get clean once, twice, three, four times and more in that endless cycle of sobriety and relapse. "She never gave up on me," said one mourner. "She helped me get my kids back after I lost them to foster care. I raised my own kids because of Lillian." Three other mourners also praised my mother for helping them get back their kids. My mother was a lifeguard on the shores of Lake Fucked. But hey, my mother's eldest daughter died in an alcoholic-fueled trailer fire. Two of her other children are active alcoholics. One is a recovering drug addict. And then there's me. The dry, drunk poet with a Scrabble board full of mental illness acronyms. Only one of my mother's children is a non-drinker and non-smoker and non-pill swallower. Her husband, our father, died of alcoholism. My mother, the healer, could not heal the people closest to her. I don't know if she tried to help us. At my mother's funeral, many other mourners talked about being publicly rebuked and shamed by her. At the powwow, a mourner said, "I sat in a folding chair, and Lillian yelled at me and told me I should let an elder have that chair. Made me cry. I was just a kid." But she was right. Lillian was always right about stuff like that. I have never sat in a folding chair at any powwow ever again. I probably won't sit in a folding chair even when I'm old. "I was at the post office," said another mourner. "This was when I was a senior in high school and we lost that big game to Selkirk. Anyway, Lillian comes walking up to me and she yells at me for being a ball hog. For shooting too much," and I yell back saying, "I pass the ball all the time." And then she yells at me about one play. At the end of the third quarter, on a fast break, I went up for a jump shot. And I was in midair when I saw Greg was opening the key. I knew I should pass to him. But I wanted to make a buzzer beater. I wanted to pass, and I wanted to shoot. Anyway, I ended up shooting, but was so distracted by everything that I threw up an air ball. I missed everything. And Lillian is yelling at me in the post office. She yells about that air ball. She tells me I shot an air ball because I felt guilty about not passing. She tells me Greg was open. She saw that Greg was open. And she was right. Man, Lillian knew basketball. Yes, my mother had vision. She had glare. So imagine how it felt to grow up under her surveillance. At her wake and funeral, after hours of listening to other Indians talk about my mother's life and death, I stood to deliver my eulogy. I'd wanted to say something epic and honest, but epics are rarely honest, and honesty should never be epic. I said, my mother and I had a difficult relationship. We weren't always kind to each other. So it's good to hear how kind she was to some of you. But it hurts, too, to hear that she mothered some of you better than she mothered me. And it was also good to hear how mean she was to some of you, too. I knew the mean Lillian maybe better than all of you. Maybe even better than my brothers and sisters. My mother was good to people, and she was mean to people, and sometimes she was good and mean to the same person at the same time. Anyway, that's all I really have to say. I am not a traditional Indian. You all know that. I don't sing or dance or do the ceremonies. I don't pray like other people pray. I just talk. So I'm really going to miss talking to my mother. I am really going to miss her voice. My mother is buried next to my father. They share a tombstone. My reservation is a very quiet place. You can hear the wind whistling through the pine trees from miles away. Hush, hush, hush. The wind says to the trees, hush, 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 the trees say to the wind. Yes, there was a 3-year span when my mother and I did not speak to each other, but I cannot remember exactly why we stopped talking to each other, and I do not remember the moment when we forgave each other and resumed our lifelong conversation. How could I have forgotten important shit like that? I have no answers for that question. And my mother has no answers either. Because she is dead. Chapter 26. Your multiverse or mine? At my mother's funeral, my smartest Indian friend, the one who never went to college, corners me to deliver a metaphysical lecture. He says, in an alternate universe exploding next to this one, you are the creator of your mother. You are her mad scientist and she is your monster. In another universe, you are the man who gives birth to his own mother. I know that sounds crazy, but speaking outside of biology, it's possible. And in the universe next to that, your mother and you are strangers who ride the same train to work every day and are always unsettled by the sense of having met before. You stare at each other all the time. And in the universe after that, well, I just blanked and can't think of any other universes, but physics teaches us that all kinds of crazy shit is theoretically possible. I mean, in another universe, maybe I'm your mother. Maybe there are 99 people totally unknown to you in this universe who are your mother in other universes, and you spend all your time in this universe trying to find the 99 people who retain a bit of that other universe maternity and can maybe give you the love and attention you ache for. Maybe there are 99 women in the world who you could have happily married because they are your mother in other universes. Maybe your wife is your mother in another universe. Or maybe I'm full of shit. Maybe I'm just trying to assuage your grief. Maybe I'm just trying to find some way to help you believe in a world beyond this one. I'm sorry I sound so crazy. I just want you to believe in something. If you won't let religion help ease your pain, Junior, then maybe you'll let science comfort you. I hugged my friend because I love him, and because I didn't know how to respond in that moment, and because I wanted him to shut up. But now, let me respond to my smart and eccentric friend with a little poem. Ah, friend, this world, this one universe, is already too expansive for me. When I die, let my mourners know that I shrugged at the possibility of other universes. Higher, acquire. Let them tell the truth, but tell it choral. Let the assembled voices sing about my theology. I'm the fragile and finite mortal who wanted no part of immortality. Chapter 27. Clothes Horse. During my mother's funeral, one of her friends, a man I'll call Xavier because I grew up vaguely Catholic, walked up to me and said, "Your shirt is wrinkled." I felt the urge to punch him. But Xavier is a tiny man. I probably would have broken his face and ended up in jail. I also felt the urge to say, "Xavier, you've been a jerk your whole damn life. I have my theories about why you've been so angry since puberty, but I ain't judging you for having those theoretical fears and doubts. I'm judging you because you've let your fears and doubts turn you into a judgmental little monster." But I didn't say any of that. I just smiled and said, "I'm always wrinkled." The smug bastard walked away. I suppose he thought that he'd burned me with his quick wit. We Spokane Indians are famous for our verbal cruelty. I'd been trained from an early age to fire insults like arrows. Hell, I've made a lucrative career out of being a smartass who can cuss you out in free verse or in rhyme and meter. But I wasn't interested in insulting Xavier back. Well, I didn't want to dishonor my mother by insulting her friend during the funeral, and maybe I had the slightest bit of compassion for him. After all, he'd been my mother's friend for years. He was in pain. But regardless of that pain, I am perfectly content to give him hell now that the funeral is only a memory. "Hey, Xavier. At my mother's funeral, did you notice that I am at least a foot taller than my sisters, nieces, and female cousins? Did you also notice that all of them were crying? So maybe, if you had noticed those things and put the clues together, Xavier, you could have solved the sartorial crime. My shirt was wrinkled because a few dozen short women had pressed their weepy faces into my chest when they hugged me. Did you also notice that my shirt was damp with tears and makeup? Dear Xavier, my shirt was wrinkled because of our family's collective grief." And, okay. I had also pulled the imperfectly folded shirt from my suitcase that morning and had briefly considered ironing it, but then thought, "Res funerals are way casual, and 90% of the Indians will be in t-shirts and jean shorts anyway, so it doesn't really matter." So yeah, honestly speaking, my shirt wasn't exactly crisp when I arrived at my mother's funeral, but my sisters and cousins had wrinkled it even more with their grief. So yeah, honestly speaking, fuck you, Xavier, and the farm-raised salmon you rode in on. Chapter 28. Eulogize Rhymes with Disguise. when I was 4 and weeping for my father gone on another binge-drinking sabbatical. My mother tore me from my bed at 4 a.m. on a December night and pushed me outside onto the porch. "You can come back in when you stop crying," she screamed and slammed and locked the door. It wasn't a freezing night, and the porch was covered so I wasn't completely exposed, and for more warmth I crawled into the doghouse with our mutts. 3 minutes or 3 hours later, I don't know which, my mother opened the door and called me back inside. But I refused. I told her I would sleep with the dogs. And I did. I did. Like some prehistoric Indian boy learning how to survive any weather or wilderness. At my mother's funeral, I heard other tribal members remember her as someone better than I had ever known. I briefly wondered if I was at a funeral for a stranger who only resembled my mother. Then my cousin, wearing a ribbon shirt and moccasins made by my mother, said, "Lillian was our last connection to the ancient stories and songs. Lillian was also a mean and foul-mouthed woman who scolded everybody. Right now, I bet you Lillian just arrived in heaven and is scolding Jesus for playing the wrong welcoming song." We all laughed and laughed, because yes, my mother was exactly the kind of mortal who challenged the gods. She was the reservation Medea. She was the indigenous Antigone. But just imagine how it felt to be her fragile child. I never stopped being afraid of her. I never left that dark porch. I am still sleeping with those dogs. Yes, I am always cold and curled like a question mark among those animal bodies as I wait for the glorious warmth of the rising sun. Chapter 29, The Undertaking. 5 days after our mother's death, we bury her next to our father. And as I stare at their shared gravestone, I see our mother's date of birth carved into the granite and realize, belatedly, that we'd forgotten to hire somebody to carve her date of death. I also realize that it was odd and equally fatalistic and romantic to have carved, at our mother's request, her name into this gravestone 12 years ago, when we buried our father, her husband. So yes, our mother lived for over a decade with her name etched above her grave to be. And now, as we lower her into the grave that is, she doesn't have an official date of expiration. Does this make her potentially immortal? If we never hire a carver to finish the gravestone, then maybe we could pretend that this funeral is yet another one of her spectacular lies. Dear mother, you bipolar necromancer, I fully expect you to rise like a shawl dancer out of your false coffin and cry, "Surprise, surprise, I am still alive." Chapter 30, The Urban Indian Boy Sings a Death Song. How does one deliver an honest eulogy? I mean, shit, shit, shit. I lied when my mother died and said nothing forceful about her cruelty or her kindness. I could have said she was crazy and dead salmon cold and pathologically lied. But who wants such honesty in a eulogy? I could have celebrated her sobriety and chastised drunk cousins for their various crimes against our tribe, or their specific cruelty with their fists and cocks against me and my body. But I would have been speaking out of angry pride. My narcissism could have turned my eulogy into law and order courtroom testimony. I could have said, I felt safe almost half the time with Mom. She protected me against cruelty 3 days a week. And yes, I know my scrutiny is dead salmon cold and probably misapplied. But I want this to be an honest eulogy about how I learned to receive and deliver cruelty. Chapter 31, Downtown. At my mother's funeral, my sister said, when she was really sick, Mom was talking about the time she lost custody of us. They only lost us once, I asked. She only talked about one time, my sister said. I'd heard stories about social service visits to our various childhood homes and knew we'd been taken away once, but I didn't know the details. When did this happen? I asked. Arlene and I were just a few months old, my sister said, and you were still just a baby, and Arnold was a toddler. Why'd they lose us? I asked. What did they do? Drinking, I'm sure, my sister said. And probably one of the times we were living in Spokane, I said. Probably. I have only impressionistic memories of living with my parents in a series of sad-ass residential hotels in downtown Spokane, and I've likely created those memories by blending old photographs I've seen firsthand with old stories I've heard secondhand. So I remember my father pulling 3 empty drawers out of a dresser to use as cribs for my 2 sisters and me. I remember the smell of cigarette smoke and body odor. I remember the old black man who worked the manual elevator in one of those places. I remember ratty area rugs and sticky wood floors. I remember a lot of Indians, familiar and strange, staring at me. But I don't have any memories, impressionistic or not, about becoming wards of the state. You think Mom was telling the truth about losing us? I asked my sister. You think she'd lie when she knew she was dying? My sister asked me. Yes, I said. My mother was a fabulist. Wouldn't her deathbed have been her greatest stage? Wouldn't the people at her bedside have been her most captive audience? Sometimes, my mother was such a gifted liar that she would fool even us children, her most ardent skeptics. But she sometimes lied so obviously that it shocked us too. After my older son was born with meconium aspiration that collapsed his lungs, he was put on a blood transfer machine for a week. Then he was in neonatal intensive care for another 2 weeks. He was critically ill. He'd crashed twice. He died and had to be resuscitated. He had a stroke. And even after he'd made it through those difficult early days, he still had major struggles with eating, walking, and talking. He has since grown into a vibrant adult, an actual Eagle Scout. But for the first year of his life, my mother told every Indian she could that my son had been born without a brain. I usually let her falsehoods go unchallenged. It was too exhausting to police all of them. But I eventually called her on the phone about that particular lie. Mom, I said, why are you telling people my son doesn't have a brain? Isn't that what's wrong with him? She asked. You know it's his lungs, I said. You know his brain was oxygen-starved and damaged, but he still has a brain, and a good one, too. He has spoken to you on the phone. Okay, she said. I thought the issue had been resolved. But then my mother told people that my son didn't have lungs. So yes, I knew that my mother was capable of slinging bullshit even as she lay dying. Mom didn't give you any details about why they lost custody of us? I asked my sister. She just said they lost us and we were put in a foster home, my sister said. I wondered what terrible shit might have happened to 4 Indian kids in 4 foster homes. She said all of us stayed together, my sister said, with that redhead white woman. She became our babysitter later, Remember her? I couldn't remember her name, but yes, I remembered that redhead. I think I remember a photograph of her visiting our home at Christmas. Are you sure Mom didn't give you more details? I asked my sister again. That's it, my sister said. That is all I know. I can only imagine how my parents might have lost us. I imagine we were living in a Spokane hotel and that my father had gone drinking at one of the nearby Indian bars, probably the Buck and Doe, and left my mother and us in the hotel room. And my mother was probably pissed to be left behind with three babies and a toddler. And since she was constantly drinking in those days, she was probably boozing it up in the room, or maybe she was suffering from a minor case of alcohol withdrawal. Maybe she was beer thirsty and going crazy in that little room. So I imagine she sang us to sleep. She had a beautiful voice and could always sing us to sleep. And then I bet she left us children sleeping in that hotel room and went to have a few drinks. I can imagine her saying to herself, "Okay, Lillian, you're going to have three beers and then you're coming back to the room to your babies." So maybe a few swallows became a lot of drinks. And I would imagine that she eventually met up with our father. They probably drank until closing time. And then they probably went to an after-hours party at somebody's house or apartment. Maybe they even came back to the hotel and partied in a nearby room. Maybe they both passed out somewhere and completely forgot about us. So I imagine that sometime during that drunken night, one of us children woke in our dark hotel room and cried. I imagine the first of us to cry woke the second baby and the third and the fourth. I imagine us as a small chorus. I imagine us crying so loud and strong that our weeping became a tribal song. I imagine us waking our hotel neighbors with our syncopated fear. I imagine hotel staff being summoned. I imagine the night manager knocking on our door. I imagine a passkey being used. I imagine the shock and disgust of discovering four abandoned Indian babies weeping and weeping and weeping and weeping. I imagine the policemen arriving. I imagine them carrying us to a county shelter with donated cribs and beds. I imagine four white women holding four sleeping Indian babies and rocking them to sleep. So yes, this seems like a plausible version of how we were lost. And it makes me sad and angry as an adult to imagine my mother returning to the hotel to discover that her babies had been officially taken away. But I cannot imagine how much shame she must have felt. "You know," I said to my sister later at the funeral, "I think Mom is telling the truth about losing us. We're never going to know the exact details, but there's too much real pain in the story for it to be a lie." My sister nodded. She agreed. But what did we agree to? Jesus. We as adults were grateful that our mother had probably told the truth about endangering us as children. How fucked is that? Chapter 32. Dear Dylan Thomas, dear Dr. Extreme, dear Rage. "Hey, climber, you fell from such a great height. Does that mean your death was somehow better than my mom's? She was in bed when she died. Hey, hiker, you fought a courageous fight, but did not survive that winter weather and were found frozen at such a great height. Hey, pilot, on your experimental flight, you shattered like a ceramic feather. My mom was wholly in bed when she died. She never base jumped or surfed in the night or walked across glacier gaps on ladders. She never touched sea floors or great heights. She was female, poor, indigenous, bright, commodified, hunted, and tape measured. She survived 100 deaths before she died. But she was never thrilled by her endangered life, so death became her gentle endeavor. We raised her last bed to a modest height. Then she sighed sighed, closed her eyes, and died. Chapter 33, Lasting Rights. I was not at my mother's side when she took her last breath. I was home in Seattle, waiting for word of her death. My sister texted, "She's gone." I collapsed with grief. But to tell the difficult truth, I also collapsed with relief. I assumed I'd be freed from my mother and her endless accusations, falsehoods, exaggerations, and deceptions. But looking at this book, I was obviously mistaken, because my mother continues to scare the shit out of me. On a morning soon after her death, my phone rang. The caller ID announced it was Mom. For a moment, I believed it was her calling from the afterlife, so I pondered what I would say. And I decided that I'd go with, "Hey Lillian, gotta say I'm impressed with your resurrection, but is it a Jesus thing or a zombie fling?" Of course, it wasn't my mother. It was my sister calling me from our mother's house. "Dang," I said to my sister, "I really thought you were Mom come back to life." And my sister said, "I know what you mean. This morning, I made her a cup of coffee and set it on the table and wondered why she hadn't drunk it yet." Dear mother, my jury, as you travel into the nocturnal, as you continue to make me hold my breath even after your death, could it be that you finally, and strangely, become maternal? Chapter 34, Equine. At my mother's funeral, I learned the three horses who'd escaped their barn years ago have transformed, have lightning and thundered into a wild herd of 400. Oh, wild horses. Oh, wild horses, as you run, I hope that my mother has become 401. Chapter 35, Feast. After we buried my mother, we feasted. Dozens of people sat in the tribal longhouse and ate venison stew, salmon, and fry bread. Hot dogs and hamburgers, Kool-Aid and soda pop, apple and cherry pie. My cousin the logger said, "Junior, I wish I saw you somewhere except funerals." I smiled. He was right. I was a stranger to him. "Did you kill this deer I'm eating?" I asked. "Yes," he said. "Thank you for hunting," I said. "Thank the deer," he said. "Yes," I said. "Bless you and bless the deer. You should come hunting with us next time." I thought he was serious and tried to imagine hobbling with my bad back through the pine forests in search of a deer or elk. But then my cousin laughed and laughed. "Little Sherm, the great Indian hunter," he proclaimed. I laughed and laughed with him and ate two more bowls of venison stew. Chapter 36, Utensil. While feasting on venison stew after we buried my mother, I recognized my spoon and realized my family had been using it for at least 42 years. How does one commemorate the ordinary? I thanked the spoon for being a spoon and finished my stew. How does one get through a difficult time? How does a son properly mourn his mother? It helps to run the errands, to get shit done. I washed that spoon, dried it, and put it back in the drawer, but I did it consciously, paying attention to my hands, my wrists, and the feel of steel against my fingertips. Then my wife drove us back home to Seattle, where I wrote this poem about ordinary grief. Thank you, poem, for being a poem. Thank you, paper and ink, for being paper and ink. Thank you, desk, for being a desk. Thank you, mother, for being my mother. Thank you for your imperfect love. It almost worked. It mostly worked. Or partly worked. It was almost enough. Chapter 37. Sibling Rivalry. Yes, my mother was a better mother to my sisters and brothers, but they were better children than me. The prodigal who yearned and spurned and never returned. Chapter 38, Eulogy. My mother was a dictionary. She was one of the last fluent speakers of our tribal language. She knew dozens of words that nobody else knew. When she died, we buried all of those words with her. My mother was a dictionary. She knew words that had been spoken for thousands of years. She knew words that will never be spoken again. She knew songs that will never be sung again. She knew stories that will never be told again. My mother was a dictionary. My mother was a thesaurus. My mother was an encyclopedia. My mother never taught her children the tribal language. Oh, she taught us how to count to 10. Oh, she taught us how to say, I love you. Oh, she taught us how to say, listen to me. And of course, she taught us how to curse. My mother was a dictionary. She was one of the last four speakers of the tribal language. In a few years, the last surviving speakers, all elderly, will also be gone. There are younger Indians who speak a new version of the tribal language, but the last old-time speakers will be gone. My mother was a dictionary, but she never taught me the tribal language, and I never demanded to learn. My mother always said to me, English will be your best weapon. She was right. She was right. She was right. My mother was a dictionary. When she died, her children mourned her in English. My mother knew words that had been spoken for thousands of years. Sometimes, late at night, she would sing one of the old songs. She would lullaby us with ancient songs. We were lullabied by our ancestors. My mother was a dictionary. I own a cassette tape, recorded in 1974. On that cassette, my mother speaks the tribal language. She's speaking the tribal language with her mother, Big Mom, and then they sing an ancient song. I haven't listened to that cassette tape in 2 decades. I don't want to risk snapping the tape in some old cassette player, and I don't want to risk letting anybody transfer that tape to digital. My mother and grandmother's conversation doesn't belong in the cloud. That old song is too sacred for the internet. So as that cassette tape deteriorates, I know that it will soon be dead. Maybe I will bury it near my mother's grave. Maybe I will bury it at the base of the tombstone she shares with my father. Of course I'm lying. I would never bury it where somebody might find it. Stay away, archaeologists. Be gone, be gone. My mother was a dictionary. She knew words that have been spoken for thousands of years. She knew words that will never be spoken again. I wish I could build tombstones for each of those words. Maybe this poem is a tombstone. My mother was a dictionary. She spoke the old language, but she never taught me how to say those ancient words. She always said to me, English will be your best weapon. She was right. She was right. She was right. Chapter 39. Drum. Am I dancing on my mother's grave? Well, my mother would have loved to be the subject of a memoir, no matter how laudatory and or critical. Or rather, if the memoir were equally positive and negative, she would have loved all of the attention.